This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices, sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Coming up on Playing with Food, Father Ian asks, what's in a sausage? And seeks an answer to that question at a local butcher shop in Guadalupe.
I'd like it because you can throw anything that you want in your sausage and make it your own.
Then KCSB News Director Rosie Boltman speaks with a peace activist who was arrested and banned from entering Israel for 99 years.
They also found a poster that had the song From the River to the Sea. Once they played that song out loud, you could tell their minds were exploding. They started asking me what terrorist organizations I worked with. It was pretty intense.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, April 28th, 2025. I'm Hair Ali. Let's start with an interview. Last week, Congressman Salud Carbajal sat down with KCBX's news director, Monica Lopez, and KCBX reporter Gabriela Fernandez to talk about the current administration's policies and actions, as well as what resonated with him at the town hall meeting that he co-hosted with Senator Adam Schiff at Cuesta College on April 22nd.
I'd start by asking you, what was your impression of last night's town hall meeting?
Well, it was very invigorating to see so many people engaged and taking time from their busy days because they're very concerned about what's happening at the federal government level. All that this administration is doing, very aggressive, crazy, chaotic actions that are really undermining our federal government agencies who have a charge to discharge a number of programs, and concerned about the executive orders that have been issued directing cuts in employment in various agencies, directing the dismantling of various agencies, many of which are illegal and unconstitutional. And the courts are working their way through making sure that they thwart those efforts as illegal and unconstitutional, but it takes time. And in the meantime, a lot of damage is being done, a lot of anxiety is being created, a lot of fears are occurring. So it was just great to see the energy and the fact that people are concerned and outraged and see them showing up. It was very encouraging for me and for our democracy because in many ways, many of our democratic institutions are at stake because that is part of what's being challenged right now by the Trump administration.
Mm-hmm. Were there any questions or topics in particular that resonated for you and your priorities?
I would say the biggest ones came back to not so much my priorities, but the biggest fear that everybody has, and that is, what if he defies the courts? Does that put us in a constitutional crisis?
Well, he has, right?
We've seen that in instances where he slow walks the court's direction. And the blatant one that we've seen is the Kilmer-Abrego deportation issue, where the Supreme Court has said, you can't do that. You need to provide due process and you need to facilitate him coming back, especially since the administration itself said that this was a mistake that they made. And the issue at stake is not even Kilmer, his deportation. It's about the rule of law, due process, and protecting the Constitution and the civil rights of all Americans. So that's really what caught my attention. And the concern that people had and the fear was of great concern.
It's to stay on that. There have been reports of what appear to be unconstitutional detentions in other parts of the country where people are being asked for their papers and all of that. What do you think are the chances that something like that could happen here?
Yes, that's a very, very important issue you raise. People who are exercising their First Amendment right and protesting, if they are protesting and they happen to be here on certain work visas or student visas, even people that are permanent residents, they are at risk by this administration of ICE going after them because they are exercising their First Amendment rights. And many students and academics that are here on student visas are now being revoked. And that's a reality. It is happening at UCSB. It's happening at Cal Poly. And so it is of great concern that this administration is taking a very dictator, authoritarian approach in our society, undermining many people's civil rights, trying to discredit the media, trying to discredit the courts, undermine the judiciary and the court system. It's of great concern.
And do you have any advice for your constituents who are worried that they could possibly be mishandled by a group of people claiming to be ICE and deporting them? Do you have any advice for those people who are concerned
about
that? Well,
if you're speaking about vigilante wannabe people that violate people's rights because they're trying to impersonate ICE officials, of course. And that's why our law enforcement, that's a crime to do that. And our law enforcement would go after those individuals. We just need to be able to identify those cases and make sure our law enforcement is protecting people's rights at the local level. We're lucky to be from the state of California. There's been a number of laws that have passed that make it very clear under what circumstances law enforcement can participate and coordinate with ICE. Unless people have serious criminal offenses, for ordinary individuals, they are not allowed to collaborate and coordinate with ICE.
Mm-hmm. One of the cases that I saw recently was a place in Montana where somebody was getting off of an Amtrak train and then they were stopped and asked for their papers. And it was unclear. I think it was Customs and Border Patrol that was doing that. So that was kind of what I was referring to when I was asking that question.
Well, I think you're going to have random instances to continue to keep that anxiety and fear throughout our country. But in order for them to do mass deportations the way they want to do that, they're going to need trillions of dollars. And with the limited personnel that they have, they are inflicting some damage in deportations now, but it's limited. The question is, how aggressive are they going to continue to get? But I will tell you, without Congress having the power of the purse and with the limited majority that they have in the House and the disarray that exists within my colleagues on the other side of the aisle, within their caucus, they're not going to be able to muster the resources that they would need to do such massive deportations. But they're going to continue to inflict fear, anxiety, and do spot apprehensions and deportations. And that in itself is going to damage our economy because we know most people here are law-abiding individuals, and they're contributing to our economy. And it's going to hurt our agriculture sector. It's going to include our hospitality sector, our tourism. It's going to include many sectors, construction, economy, and sector. All that's at stake. And our economy's already being impacted by the ridiculous trade wars and tariffs that this president is starting to implement. And we all see the impact to the market as well as various sectors in our general economy.
You mentioned the international students that have had their visas revoked. I'm not sure how many thousands of people it is as of today, but I've been noticing that the number goes up by several hundred every few days. Will you be watching the subcommittee hearing on workforce and education with Cal Poly SLO President Armstrong having to answer the questions about whether he mishandled, quote-unquote, mishandled violent anti-Semitic protests?
Well, my intent, certainly, I'm interested in seeing the hearing, but I have hearings of my own that oftentimes conflict with other committee hearings. So we'll see what my schedule allows. But certainly it's very concerning that this administration is taking those actions and the subpoena that has happened. It's all under the guise of addressing anti-Semitism, but we all know that's just the guise that my colleagues are using. Their big approach is, again, the so-called assault on DEI, and all of a sudden disregarding one of their principles that they've always been for, states' rights and local control. But when it's convenient, they say they're for states' rights and local control. When it's not, and they want to implement a nationwide doctrine, extreme right-wing doctrine that they believe in, then it's okay. And that's what they're doing now.
And what you also mentioned earlier, which was about free speech, right? About being able to protest.
And again, this administration says it's a protector of free speech. But what they mean to say is they're a protector of extreme right-wing speech, but everyone else, absolutely not. You know, when this administration, this president was running for office, he said on day one he was going to bring down inflation. And we've seen executive order after executive order, or over 230 executive orders. We haven't seen one piece of legislation or one executive order that would bring down the cost of groceries, the cost of childcare, the cost of housing, the cost of energy, gas, healthcare, nothing. So this president sold a bill of goods to the American people. And certainly he did win. You can't take that away from him. But many are having buyer's remorse now because he is doing nothing to address the number one economic concern of Americans, and that is to bring down the cost of everyday items that they are experiencing when they go shopping for their families, to put food on the table, to provide health care, to put shelter over their heads.
Back to the subcommittee meeting. I'm curious to know, why do you think Cal Poly was chosen? We were kind of joking around in the newsroom earlier, and we were talking about how they might have confused the Cal Poly SLO campus with the Humboldt campus because there was, you know, those incidents that had happened last year where they barricaded one of their buildings. Just curious to hear from you, you know, why you think the campus might have been chosen.
Well, I wish I had a crystal ball to tell me how this extreme, chaotic, reckless administration does anything. Who knows? All I know is that everything about this administration has been reckless, chaotic, misinformed, misguided, and that's what we're seeing in all their actions. We saw the danger that they're posing to our national security with one of the most unqualified cabinets in the history of the United States, and in this case, the Secretary of Defense, and all the actions that they've been taking that really undermine the intelligence and the procedures we have in place for classified information.
What are the plans to address, or are there plans to address the shortfall from USDA cuts for local food assistance programs?
Well, keep in mind that this administration is moving forward with a budgetary procedure called reconciliation, so they could overcome the 60-vote threshold that exists in the Senate. And the way they do that is through a process called reconciliation. And to do that, they passed a budget resolution to be able to lay the foundation to pursue that legislation. And in that budget resolution, what they've telegraphed is that they want to cut $880 billion from Medicaid, funding for Social Security staff, funding for SNAP, Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, in the amount of $240 billion. This is funding that would go to feed the most needy, food insecure families and individuals in our country. And they're trying to do this to find some money to be able to justify the $4.5 to $7 trillion tax giveaway, tax break that they want to give to the wealthiest Americans, the top 1% wealthiest Americans, like they did last time. In Trump 1.0, they passed a budget tax reform bill that gave 83% of the benefit to the top 1% richest Americans and corporations in our country. And they're trying to do that again. Last time, they were selective about their fiscal responsibility and added a huge amount of debt to our national debt and our deficits. They are going to do the same thing, but they're trying to lessen that a little bit by cutting all these programs for education, for EPA, for transportation, everything that goes to put up our healthcare, Medicaid system, and our supplemental nutrition assistance programs so that they can justify that they found a little bit of money. It's only going to be pennies on the dollar from all the money that they're going to give away in tax breaks to the wealthiest Americans.
Mm-hmm. And then one final question is that what does a courageous action from a congressional representative look like to you in this moment?
A courageous action means do everything we can to make sure that we're speaking out, that we are protesting, that we are highlighting all the illegal and unconstitutional actions that this administration is doing. It means drawing attention to it in whatever non-traditional ways that oftentimes are used. And like I said, by protesting, sit-ins. But more importantly, engaging our constituents in the most informed and transparent way so that they could have the information to protest and to speak out and to be informed. Because at the end, this is about all hands on deck. Not just members of Congress, Democrats in the minority. Keep in mind, we're in the minority, speaking out and moving forward legislation, and we're trying to lure some Republicans to come with us, but that is unlikely for the most part. But it's helping those that are litigating, supporting litigation through the courts. It is continuing to work on the number one thing that the public wants us to address, lower the cost, everyday cost of living for Americans, for healthcare, for housing, for groceries, for gas, for energy, making sure that we're doing that. So it's a time to be speaking out, to be energized, and to be very present, because we are under assault. Our democracy is under assault, and the civil rights of Americans are under assault.
All right. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
I appreciate it.
Thank you.
That was Congressman Salud Carbajal speaking with KCBX's news director, Monica Lopez, and KCBX reporter, Gabriela Fernandez. This is Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Next, Father Ian is playing with food, this time at Lobo Butcher Shop in the city of Guadalupe.
Have you ever heard that relationships are somewhat like sausages? They're great until you start picking them apart and find out what's inside. I don't actually believe that about sausage. Hot dogs, yes, but not sausages. So I thought I would get on the other side of that saying and see what actually goes into sausages so I don't have to be concerned ever again. So I went down to Lobo Butcher Shop in Guadalupe, where there is a wide variety of both traditional and new and interesting sausages.
My name is Ernesto from Lobo Butcher Shop.
Your establishment is in the back of a convenience store.
Yes, it is. I was looking for a location. I've been a butcher for 15 years, and I decided that I want to start to go to business for myself. So 3 years ago, came in. My in-laws lived next door, and I saw that there's a three-compartment sink and that there was a bunch of beer cases everywhere. And from there, it was just, I asked how much they wanted and came up with the price and opened up a store. Today, we're going to make our famous Guadalupe, named after the town. So it's a jalapeno bratwurst, and then I just named it Guadalupe because all the greenery and the algae culture and stuff. So I want to name something after the town. There's pork shoulder I'm going to debone, and then also I'm going to mix some jalapenos. I do add just a tad bit of beef fat just because it adds more juice into the sausage, makes it a little bit juicier. Yeah, just go ahead and grind it up, and I'll show you the process and everything. We'll go from there.
Okay, great. You said you've been a butcher for 15 years. Where did you learn your craft?
I started off at Vaughn's in Santa Barbara, so I'm originally from down there. I worked at Vaughn's, Gelson's, Sprouts, and I've also worked at a mom and pop shop called Country Market down in Santa Barbara. Just something that I caught on to when I was younger and something that I realized that I can do and came naturally to me.
Where do you source your meat? Is it local?
I use my local vendors. Try to get as local as I can. The people I use, they're out of Paso Robles and San Luis Obispo. I've been doing it for over about 10 years of making sausage. I learned from a gentleman whose whole family grew up in the whole butchery aspect. And before he retired, he taught me everything that he pretty much knew. Sausage was one of them. I'd like it because you can throw anything that you want in your sausage and make it your own. It is a lost art. There's not too many butcher shops or anything that will still go ahead and make sausage. I feel like it's starting to make a comeback, but it's not as like it used to be.
How many different flavors of sausages do you have?
I make about 18 different flavors, and that's not including if I add cheese.
I see in your case that you do some typical ones like chorizo and spicy Italian and sweet Italian. Do you do any others that are unique to the store other than the Guadalupe?
Yeah, I do a Hawaiian. It's a pineapple apple mix, so right when you bite into it, you just feel the freshness of like the beach. And so I decided to call that one the Hawaiian. The Hawaiian is definitely one of my top sellers besides this Guadalupe, and the linguica are my top three. But when the seasons come, I do like a Polish, or summertime comes, I'll do a kielbasa. If I have time, I always experiment when I do have time to go ahead and say, hey, maybe I'll make this one, or do this.
Are there seasonings and flavorings that always work and some that never work?
I mean, that's what the whole point of messing around with the sausages. You know, you make a little 5-pound batch and then you have your customers try it out to say, hey, what do you think of this? A lot of the stuff goes together. It all depends what kind of sausage you're going for. Like if you want like a breakfast one.
Have you ever made ones that you just thought, this is really bad?
I did a garlic one and it came out too garlicky. Some people said it was good, some people didn't, but I think they just never hurt my feelings. But that's the only one that I think I've got so far that hasn't came out the way I wanted to. One of my, he's like my brother. He loves garlic. So he's like, yeah, I'll take them all. And I was like, all right, here you go. So they didn't go to waste.
And what about sausages with other meats? Do you use chicken and beef and turkey? So
I haven't made any turkey sausages here, but I've done them before. It's more of a supply and demand. You asked me to make you a special like turkey sausage. That's not an issue. I do have one in the case right now. It's a chicken spinach feta. I made that one to go with like an Alfredo pasta. Super convenient because it already has the cheese, it has the spinach, and it has the feta in there. So all you gotta do is just cut it up into little circles and throw it into your chicken Alfredo. You don't have to cook the chicken because it's already in there. So it's basically all in one. This is about the 25 pounds right here. So next step is to go ahead and grind it.
Do you grind it with the seasonings?
No, I do the seasonings after because I don't want the seasonings to get stuck into the grinder in the head right there. If you add the seasoning beforehand, you can do that, but the seasonings end up in the head right there, the sausage, and you lose flavor.
This is larger than a home kitchen grinder.
This is a 32, the head right here. There's a 12, a 22, a 32, 42, and I believe there's a 52.
That's the diameter in millimeters of the plate that has the holes in it where the ground meat comes out.
This one's a 32. This is the smallest commercial size grinder you can get.
But you do put the jalapenos in.
Yeah, so what I do is I throw the jalapenos in first because the juice sits in there. So I want the meat to grind in with that juice. And then all this jalapeno is going to go on the bottom of the tote. After we're all done grinding, I put the seasoning on top, the jalapenos on the bottom, and then we go ahead and mix it.
I see that you've included the ribs and the seeds. So is this a pretty spicy sausage?
It all depends on the batch. It's just jalapenos. You just never know. I do try to make it so it's not as spicy. So I'll get like a handful. You know, I don't want to make it too spicy where people don't like it or they can't handle it. Typically, I get people that do want that spicier sausage.
So as it's coming out, it kind of looks like white pellets.
And that's just the fat from the pork.
Did you make sausages every day?
Yeah. I've been trying to talk to a couple restaurants about my sausage and stuff. It is a lot better for you because I don't add any fillers or preserves or hormones or gluten-free, GMO-free, all that stuff. So I'm trying to find a couple deals and stuff that a couple restaurants where they want some freshly made stuff that doesn't have all the preservatives. I mean, it is a little more expensive, but at the same time, too, it tastes the way it's supposed to taste, not how people add flavors and stuff that you're not supposed to be eating. So next, we're going to go ahead and add the seasoning.
You have a bus tub of ground pork.
Ground pork, but underneath we did the jalapenos first and then the ground pork. And then we're going to throw the seasoning on top. And then we're going to make sure the consistency is good when we add the seasoning into it. Sometimes you do have to add a tad bit of water just to go ahead and make it a little bit better. Just make it that right consistency.
So what seasonings do you have?
Salt, white pepper, spices, mustard, cane sugar. I don't want to reveal the rest of my secrets with the sausage. So you just mix it by hand. So typically that phrase when people say you have sausage fingers, you get it from making sausage in your fingers. They typically, they get bigger from mixing everything around. When they say sausage fingers, they really mean sausage fingers.
So this batch is 25 pounds. Is that the typical batch size that you do?
If I'm in a hurry and I don't have that much time, I'll just do 25 pound batches because my sausage stuff over there, it only holds 30 pounds at a time. I usually do about 40 to 50 pounds if I'm gonna do sausage because we do sell them a lot. Our top sellers here is actually really sausage because there's not too many people that make homemade sausages like we said earlier. If you like, if you wanna try one of these, I could throw one on the smoker for you too and that way you could try it out if you want.
Sure.
I don't know if you like spicy stuff. If you want to try a different one, you can, or if you don't mind spice.
I do like spicy.
Oh, okay. We do make usually a habanero one as well, which I should have made a habanero.
What are you doing here?
This is where the sausage I put in. It's my sausage stuffer. It comes out through here. I put my casings on here. It's like a sleeve that goes over, and I put the meat in here and just go on and crank away. There's mechanical thing where like foot pedals where it does it for you. And I try to do more of an old school style because I want the old ways still continue compared to what it is now. Everyone relies on their machines to go out and do everything. You know, a little bit of hand cranking keeps me a little in shape, you know. This right here is a natural hog casing. So this is pig intestines. It's already cleaned and everything. That's what goes above this part of the machine. It just slips on and on. I'll show you right now once I put the meat into the sausage stuffer, and I'll show you how the rest goes.
You're listening to KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Father Ian, and I'm finding out what goes into sausages at Lobo Butcher in Guadalupe. To my delight, the only ingredients that go into Ernesto's sausages are meat, some fat, and the seasonings. Ernesto ground the meat and fat and added ground fresh jalapenos and spices. Now he's putting the natural casing onto the sausage stuffer. It's a vertical chute with a horizontal nozzle at the bottom. The casing goes onto the nozzle and it stretches and expands as the sausage meat comes out. And then Ernesto makes the links. So you're just piling it into this long cylinder. This, it's about 8 inches in diameter and about 2 feet tall?
This is the size of 30 pounds. I try to keep everything in there at one batch at a time because if, say, you have a little bit left like this right here and you start cranking it and then you have to uncrank it and then put more in. In between, you get an air bubble and it'll come through the casing and you don't want that. So that's the reason why I try to do everything 50-pound batch, so I try to split it up 25-25. There is this little machine where you poke holes, so you take out the air bubbles. I'm gonna grab some hog casings. Make sure to untangle it first because they do like to get tangled in here.
Then you cinch it up on the nozzle.
Yeah.
And then we'll get to see it all come out.
Yeah.
There we go. It's all on there.
I put my pinky in the hole and I already took out most of the air, so I'm gonna go ahead and crank this. So right there, I feel it coming in already. So I go ahead and hold it, and I pinch it right there.
Why don't you tie a knot in the end?
You can do that. Just in case there's a little bit more air, I can go ahead and see how my hand's covering it. I can open it up a little bit, let the air out. Sometimes if you tie a knot, you just end up with the air bubble right there. And it's just a pain.
So you're doing it in one long tube. You're not twisting it off.
No, we'll do the twisties after. And there's people that do the twist at the same time, but that's when I have a machine. If I have a machine and it's cranking for me, you know, I only have two hands. I'm not going to do both at the same time.
How often does the casing tear?
If you know what you're doing, it won't really tear on you, but if you overstuff it, it'll tear. And like when I teach people how to do it, they go ahead and they make the sausage. They pack it too much, it'll tear on them when you try to twist it. Remember earlier when I was saying that you want kind of squishy? So that way, when you do it, and if it's too hard in the casing, and you're trying to turn it, then it'll tear.
And that's when you're making the links when you're twisting it?
Yes.
Okay, so you've gone through your second casing, which wasn't as long as the first one.
No. And so when you make that noise, you're pretty much done. So you go ahead and grab this. You get your knife, punch it at the end. But you see how that last one, I used a smaller casing? Mm-hmm. Because you don't want a bunch of small casings, so. Throw that back in the water. And now we're going to go ahead and link.
Okay, does this take some special skill?
It doesn't. It's a long process to remember. You're going back and then you're going forth and you're going back and then forth, back and forth. In my head, I've been doing it for so long. I just try to make it the same size. See how I turn to the right? So I'm going to turn the opposite way because if you turn the same way, it'll go ahead and unravel the whole thing.
It's about the width of your hand, pinky to thumb, and then you twist the first link to the right and the second link to the left. Right, left, right, left?
Yes.
How many twists do you do?
About two or three. Sometimes one. It all depends. Like this one, how it twisted itself. Sometimes you get to that. Gotta make sure when you pull these and they're stacked on top of each other, because when you pull it on the bottom and there's all that weight from the top, they will tear on you. You won't get a full link.
If it tears, do you have to start over again? Restuff them?
No, if it tears, I put it in my bulk pile, and I have customers that come in and get it in bulk, and that way they just add it with their eggs.
So out of the casing?
Yeah.
How many links will this make?
This 25 pounds. I put them in packs of 12. You get about 70, around 70.
How much does each weigh approximately?
I try to make them to about a third of a pound.
That's a generous sausage.
Yeah, yes. I mean, they recommend half pound per person when you make meals and stuff. We get to the end right here. That one's obviously going to be half pound, you know. You
can't. That's a big one.
Yeah. Just cut off the excess casing right there. And then from there, I just go ahead and I cut and I make a pile right here. And at the very end, I will go ahead and start my packaging process. Right where it's twisted, I go ahead and cut. So I get that length so that way it doesn't seep out the side when you go ahead and cook it. Or don't get a weird looking sausage when you're cooking it.
You twist it only two or three times. So why doesn't the twist come undone when you cut it at the twist?
Sometimes it does. If I cut too close to the sausage, it will come undone. But I'm just making a cleaner cutting point for me. I've done it before when I was first starting, and I cut it too close to the sausage. And it looks like an effective sausage. Go ahead and coming out the side.
with no preservatives and no artificial colors or flavors or anything, how long will these last in the fridge?
About 5 days. It could last a little bit longer, but for legal reasons, I gotta say 5 days for health department reasons. Because after 5 days, I can't sell it after five. They're still good after that. But after 5 days, I go ahead and I either take them home or give them away to some family member. They typically sell, you'll see right now, I put them in the freezer. So I only take out 12 at a time. I don't have to sell a whole 25 pounds in 5 days, which pretty much they do anyway, but just you never know.
I'm surprised it doesn't squeeze out the other end because you're doing a little bit of displacement by twisting it, but it doesn't come out the end by the time you get to the end of the casing.
No, because like I was telling you before, if you go ahead and make it where it's super hard, then it'll go ahead and do that. But if you do it where you want that little squishiness, that way you can play with it a little bit and it won't pop on you. That's why I was saying you don't want to overstuff it because then it will pop. If you don't do it right, it will come out at the end.
So don't understuff and don't overstuff.
Yeah, we gotta find that happy medium, I guess.
You've got all of these sausages linked now, and you're going to package them?
Yeah, I cut the butcher paper that I have. I cut it in half, and it's a perfect link to the sausage. After that, then we put them in plastic wrap. We write what flavor they are, and then we write the date on there so that we can figure out which ones to sell first. So we're gonna put 6 on the bottom. Then we're gonna put 6 more on top. After that, we're gonna go ahead and close it. Grab a Sharpie. Write Guadalupe on there. And then the date.
21st. Ta-da.
Yep.
So you got them all packaged up here. What are you going to do with that big one?
Throw it in the case. They're not going to fit in the other length. So what I do is put that one on first, smile towards the customer, and then I just go ahead and reload the other ones, put the older ones in the back, and they'll be gone by tomorrow.
I'm happy to buy the big one from you.
Yeah, whatever you want.
Okay, so you put this in your smoker for how long?
It takes about 10, 15 minutes. Get it to about 155. That I pulled out at 160. And then you just saw all the juices come out and everything. So I'm going to cut it up for you right now and you can try it out.
Are sausages popular with your catering?
Yeah, everybody loves a good sausage, you know. I get people that tell me that once they've had mine that they don't like to go to the grocery store and get the ones from the store because those ones are filled with fillers and preservatives and everything. Well, go ahead and try it out.
Okay, here we go. Really nice flavor. And the texture is different even.
Yeah.
And it's fresh, if you can say that about a sausage. Yeah. It tastes much fresher than anything you buy in a supermarket.
Yeah.
You're listening to KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I just saw how sausages are made at Lobo Butcher in Guadalupe. I took some of Ernesto's jalapeno brats home, and I'm going to try them with some homemade sausages that a parishioner made from his deer hunt. So my friend Jeff came to my house for dinner. So I'm here with my friend Jeff. Jeff, we are going to have sausages for dinner tonight. I have the Guadalupe sausage from Lobos Meat Company in Guadalupe. It's a bratwurst sausage with jalapenos in it. And then I have a parishioner who hunts and he makes sausage from the venison. And I have a Swiss-style venison sausage and a Swiss-style chorizo sausage. Do any of those sound interesting to you?
They all three sound interesting.
Okay, so we're going to just put them in my grill pan because, you know, it's the middle of winter and I'm not going to fire up the barbecue. I did think about putting them in the oven and roasting them, but we're just going to put them on the grill pan. So we're heating up the grill pan and we're going to do that. So we have these three sausages. What wine should we have with them?
Well, I brought a Letitia Pinot Noir. It is the Clone Touré Wattensville from the Arroyo Grande Valley. And this is a 2019.
A local wine for local sausages. Let's go for it. So what we have here are the three sausages. Dig in.
Okay, can't wait.
So this one's which?
I think that one is the Swiss.
And then this one is?
The one in the middle is the Guadalupe sausage.
With the jalapeno?
Yeah.
In fact, I can see jalapeno seeds in it.
It's very meaty. The spices are really nice. They don't hit you over the head. They kind of sneak up behind you and whisper in your ear.
This sausage is nice. And what I would say is that it's definitely very different than a mass manufactured sausage. It feels fresher. Even though I took it out of the freezer and I've had it for a couple months, it feels more, I don't know, is authentic the right word?
Yeah. I understand what you're trying to articulate, yeah. You get the impression that you're not eating a whole bunch of sulfites.
Definitely, yeah. This one is Guadalupe sausage. He smoked one for me, but this one is grilled. But still, I think I have the same things to say about this one that I grilled as I did with the one he smoked. And it's so different than a commercial sausage. It's so much fresher, and it feels like, I don't know, it just feels dumb to say this, but it feels homemade.
Even some of the higher-end commercially produced sausages still have a greasier taste to them than these do.
A butcher sausage and a hunter sausage are definitely in a different class than commercial sausages. And the sausage-making process was so simple, I could probably make sausages at home if I had the meat grinder attachment to my KitchenAid. The ingredients are simple, and the only resemblance to a relationship is, perhaps, that a good relationship needs just a few high-quality ingredients and leave out the junk. And Ernesto has the best advice for finding out just how good they are.
You know, I try to go ahead and make them as fresh as possible, and then that whole batch probably won't even last till next week. It'll sell out by then, and whoever's tried them before, they'd say, I can't eat the ones at the grocery store anymore because these ones taste so much fresher and better. You can't explain it, but that's why I tell people, I let my food do the talking instead of me.
Check out your local butcher's sausages and let the food do the talking. This is KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. I'm Father Ian, and I'm playing with food.
Our next story is from KCSB's The People's Program.
Welcome. I'm Rosie Boltman. Today, the People's Program welcomes Alex, an activist with the International Solidarity Movement who was working to stop Israeli settler violence against Palestinians when they were arrested by Israeli forces. They were sent back to the United States this month and has been banned from Israel for 99 years.
My name is Alex, born and raised here in Santa Barbara, Chumash Territory.
And you were recently in the West Bank, which is what we're here to talk about. Can you just start off by telling us why you were there?
I went to the West Bank as part of a protected presence. I went with a group called ISM, International Solidarity Movement, and they've been around for over 25 years. And you basically just go to the West Bank and you spend time with families that are being attacked by settlers or trying to be pushed off their land. So we're literally just living and staying with the families, hoping that our presence detours violence, or if and when there is violence, by us being present and filming, it'll decrease the level of violence they face.
So this isn't your first time going to the West Bank. Can you talk about how long you've been going and how you got into doing this?
So my first time I went was only last year. I went for a month in August and September. And I've been following Palestine for over 24 years, and I've heard about ISM and Protective Presence back when Rachel Corrie was murdered by the IOF. And I had never gone because I always felt I had to have some special skill, or I just didn't know that was something that I could do. I always thought it was like, you know, doctors or lawyers or people with more special skills. And last year I had a friend hit me up and be like, hey, I'm going. Do you know anyone who wants to go? And I was like, what would that look like? I would definitely want to go with you. And so I got to go out there. I got to realize how easy it is to go and how much it's wanted by the Palestinian people, how badly they want people to come out there, not only for protective presence, but just to share their culture and like, their stories, and so people can see them in real time, which makes it completely different than even, you know, our phones and the internet and TV. And now my main goal with doing report backs and advocating for this is I want to break down all those myths. Like, I don't know how many people I've talked to since I've been back that are like, wait, you can just go to the West Bank? Like, how can you do that? The West Bank is where Jerusalem is. Like, that is Bethlehem. Like, all these places that everyone knows, that's actually in the West Bank. And anyone can fly there. You know, you don't have to just go there as protective presence. You could go there. And I don't usually advocate tourism because I really hate tourism. But that is something that even there people want. If you want to go spend a week or 2 weeks and stay in hotels and stay in Ramallah and some of the major cities where you won't have to worry about violence by settlers or the state, they really want that.
And the reason I invited you on this show is because I recently got word and saw pictures of you being taken away by Israeli forces and sent back to the United States. Can you tell us that story? What happened to you during that process?
So it started off in the morning. The place I spent in the last month and a half, I was there for a month and a half before I was kicked out, was Masa Furuyata, just south of there in a town called Tawani. It's actually, for people that have seen the film No Other Land, that pretty much is exactly where we were staying. A lot of those families in those videos are families we stayed with, the people we worked with. And so we were out in the town, and we saw seven military and police vehicles go by. A couple minutes later, we got a call from another international that had been staying at this house, which was outside of Tawani. So it was a very isolated, three families that were isolated. These Bedouin communities are all over the West Bank, where people live pretty, were more nomadic, but now have permanent structures due to the system that's in place now. But they still are herding their goats, their sheep, chickens, making cheese, living on the land. And so these rural homes are the ones that are getting attacked the most. And so people will spend the night at them. We had someone spending the night at this house. And around 6 in the morning, right as sunrise is happening, three settlers, probably in their late teens, early 20s, with M16s, showed up to the house with a herd of about 100 sheep and goats. And we're literally, the closest settlement was over a mile away, maybe a mile and a half. So these settlers intentionally came to this house, started grazing their sheep on their land, in their gardens, in their fields where they're trying to grow crops. And they tried to break into the house, screaming and yelling in Hebrew. And they ended up opening the doors, pointing guns at everybody, screaming. You know, most people can't speak Hebrew, so we don't know what they were saying. He ultimately threw a knife, a kitchen knife, down at the feet of the Palestinians. And then the settlers pulled out their cameras and filmed that, and then picked up the knife and then called the police and told the police that the Palestinians had pulled a knife on them, which, just a little thinking about that, wouldn't make sense, right? You have people with M16s pointing at you. What's a knife going to do? But this is something that happens normally. They create scenarios to make their lives harder. Besides terrorizing them, they also have false charges. This happened to me last year when I was in Palestine also, where I was arrested for assaulting settlers when settlers were actually assaulting me. Everything's upside down there. So this one international called us. Two of us responded, or a couple of people responded to a neighboring village to take pictures from a distance. Two of us responded. It was in a closed military zone, which is a new thing. Well, not a new thing, but it's expanding, where they're making vast areas of the West Bank, a third of it now, are called closed military zones. So Palestinians still have homes and lands on those areas, but it makes it so that tourists or foreigners are no longer allowed to go there. But we still chose to go because we were asked. The one person that was by themselves was a little intimidated. You know, the four Palestinian men had been zip-tied and were on the ground. Their hands were turning purple. So we made the decision that we felt like the two of us walking into the situation would be better than not going. Because, again, by us being present, the soldiers behave different. The settlers tend to behave different. So we responded. We got out there. We were instantly called down from the hill where we were taking pictures. They searched us. I made us sit on the ground for about 45 minutes while the army, the police, and the settlers all conspired for like 45 minutes, pretty much getting their stories straight on what they were going to, you know, charge everybody with. Never asked us our side of what happened or the Palestinian side. They ended up arresting three of us, internationals, and two Palestinians, and took us into custody to be interrogated. And the two Palestinians were let go by the evening, and the two other internationals were let go maybe within like 6 hours. I was interrogated a little longer. They found my record from being arrested when I was there last year, which made them look a little more, I think. They found my social media is not in my name and connected to me, but they still, you know, technology is, it's theirs. It works for them. They figured out my social media, saw pictures of me from the year before where I was just with a bunch of youth. It was like 10 young girls between the ages of like 8 and 2. And I'm smiling with them. And they're like, what is this picture? You're with a bunch of Palestinian children and you look happy. Like, what? How do I answer that? Like, what do I say? And then they also found a post where it had the song From the River to the Sea. And that was pretty much, once they played that song out loud, it was like the worst thing ever. You could tell their minds were exploding. They were like, started asking me what terrorist organizations I work with, who's funding me, who paid for me to get there, why I'm trying to demonize the Jews and why I want everyone to hate Jews. So yeah, just a lot of really intense comments about being a terrorist. And it was pretty intense. But ultimately, they deported, kicked me out, took me to another place the next day where I had another deportation hearing, asked me a bunch more questions, but I had a lawyer present that time, so it was a little more professional, whatever. And I was, typically they kick people out for 10 years. I was banned for 99 years. That's the time they gave me.
So during your most recent trip, DropSite News published an article on March 6th that said, State of Siege, Israel is conducting its largest mass expulsion campaign in the West Bank. How have you seen displacement occurring in real time when you've been in Palestine?
In the first month I was there, over 40,000 people were displaced in the Jenin camp alone. And I think it's around like 15 or 20,000 were being displaced in the Turkmen refugee camp. It's literally an everyday thing. And then every day in the West Bank, there's thousands and thousands of homes slated for demolition, and they just don't know when it's going to happen. And so just in the time I was there, we got to see five different homes destroyed, even some caves. So in the Masafriyatta area, there's a lot more ancient caves where people have lived in them for hundreds of years. It's staggering the amount of destruction that's happening there and displacement. But then in the same breath, it's really amazing to see like the community coming together and holding each other together. Every house that we go to, every Bedouin community we've been at, people are like building additions or like digging out caves and making caves bigger. Like people are like anticipating having to take in other people. Even with like the massive displacement of people, I never saw anyone anywhere begging. There's no one sitting on the street. Like they're taking care of each other, which is just really amazing to see the level of displacement, but then also the level of like solidarity and community coming together. It's really, really amazing.
So when you told the story of your deportation from Israel, you told a horrible story about settler treatment of Palestinians in the West Bank. And Americans like ourselves are a part of that settler population. CBS reported in December of 2024 that about 15% of the West Bank's settlers are American.
So well, there's a lot of open land in Palestine. And one thing that I really noticed this time that I didn't notice last time is that the settlements are like constantly being built right on top of existing Palestinian communities. It's not like there's no other place for them to go. Like they're intentionally antagonizing and like putting pressure. All these little villages around Masafriyatta that are, some are like 800 years old, some are older than that, but like people's families have been living in some of these for over 800 years. And then there's settlements, like pretty much every community you're in, any direction you face, it's like a horseshoe or a full circle of settlements. And some of those settlements are so close that they literally can just like throw their bags of trash over the fence and it will land in the backyard of like a Palestinian home or land in the backyard of a school. So there's just trash everywhere. It's a type of warfare that's constant between them dumping trash, playing music loud at night, going out and practicing shooting guns, or just drunk settlers just staggering through Palestinian towns. A lot of people in America think that, oh, the settlers are in danger and they have to protect themselves. That's why they have guns and that's why they have fences around their houses. And really, it's like no one will dare do anything to them because it'll only come back like a hundredfold. If one settler was walking drunk through Tawani and someone attacked him, that town would be burned to the ground. And who knows how many people would be killed. And a lot of these settlements, you know, are people that are pretty marginalized themselves. They've been brought in from other countries. They're poor. And so they actually don't have much. And a lot of them come into these Palestinian communities just to steal things that they need, you know, whether it's stealing the lights off of houses or solar panels or sheep or furniture or bicycles, whatever they can't grab for themselves, you know, they just destroy, they burn the rest or smash the rest. It's the most mind-boggling thing I've ever seen, and I can't even quite understand where the headspace is that people can behave this way. I know a lot of them are motivated by their God and their stories of it belonging to them. But even with that mindset, like how a group of people can treat another group of people the way they do is really, it's something else.
Do you have any stories or moments that you can describe that speak to the ongoing Palestinian resistance in the West Bank, or any positive moments that you've gotten to experience with Palestinians?
Yeah, I mean, just everywhere you go, the amount of love and resilience and hospitality is just mind-numbing. If you're in the West Bank and not in a settlement, like, they can tell internationals. And if you're there as international, they can pretty much assume that you're there in support of them. So any city or town you go to, you're constantly inundated with, where are you from? Who are you? How long are you here for? Come to my house, have tea. Come to my house, have coffee. Come meet my kids. Like, hear my story. Like, beautiful stories, horrible stories. Walking through, like, Ramallah, Jenin, Nablus, Hebron, any of these places, Al-Quds or Jerusalem, like, people are just trying to give you free food. People want you to stop and hang out with them. They want you to hear their stories. You know, they want you to see their humanity. And a lot more people can speak English than you would think. West Bank has a super high literacy rate with, like, knowing multiple languages, people with degrees. You know, most people there are just laborers because there's no work for them. But when the day comes that they are free, they have an extremely educated group of youth there. There's that old saying, like, existence is resistance. And I've never really understood that fully. But in the West Bank, I really got to see that and understand that. Like, existence is resistance. Sending your kid to school, your kid might not make it back. Or your kid might make it back and your house is gone. Going out to pick olives, going to work in the garden, going to the grocery store, standing in the window of your house, all these things could ultimately lead to your death. And so, like, existence is resistance there. Every single person we met has a loved one that's been killed. And every single person we met not only had someone that was killed, but someone that was in prison. And they didn't know if or when they were going to see them again. And so dealing with so much repression on so many levels, and then still seeing people, kids playing in the streets and adults laughing and giggling and, you know, planting more, like, a bunch of olive trees get cut down and then you just order a bunch more the next week and you just plant it more. You know, that's pretty amazing.
So I'm curious if you've ever interacted with somebody who is Israeli but is doing solidarity actions in Palestine.
Definitely. One thing we did see one day, which the people I was with were like, I've never seen that. There was like a dozen Israelis in a roundabout, and most of their signs said Palestinian Lives Matter. And it was pretty amazing to see, and I bet it was super dangerous for them because they were near a settlement. But there's also other groups. One of the groups that was working in the same town we were is called the Hebrew Speakers, and so they're all Israeli. And when I was out there last year in the Jordan Valley, there was also this group of like 8 or 9. They didn't have a name for themselves, but they were just people in their like 70s that just go around and stay at houses and like do food drop-offs. There's been a lot of rallies, actually, like marches in Tel Aviv in the last couple months, which have been met with some extreme violence by the police and Israelis attacking their own people. I don't remember the name of them, but there's also a large group of soldiers that have refused to serve, and ex-soldiers also that are trying to make amends for the service they did, you know, exposing what they did see. They don't want you to hear about it, but there's definitely plenty of Israelis that are not okay with what's happening.
How have your experiences in Palestine changed you and your perspective on the world?
And I heard this from so many Palestinians themselves, being like, because you asked, what can we do as Americans or what can we do as internationals? And the two main things they say over and over again is they want people to come there. They want people, because protective presence is great, but they also want people to experience their culture, get to know them, see them, and take that back with them. Before I went to Palestine, I think maybe I felt a little more hopeless about the situation there. And now that I've gone there, even with everything that's happened in Gaza and what's happening now again in the last couple of days, is that like their steadfastness is like they're not going anywhere, and they're super confident in that. And they're just like, yeah, one day America and the other countries are going to stop funding Israel, and we're going to get rid of these people ourselves. The only reason they can stay here is because they have the money you're sending them and the weapons. The moment they don't have weapons, like whoever's not willing to live with us, like coexist with us, is going to be gone. And it was really beautiful to see that confidence that they had, and seeing the level of just how hard life is in general on every level for them, and seeing how well they still hold it together. It made me stronger, and it really makes me want to encourage more people to go there to experience that for themselves, because here activism is like a thing you do when you want to do, and it's not like a lifestyle. And so maybe we need to start looking at everything we do has an impact, from what we purchase to how we treat each other. And it's going to take all of us, and like they need us, and they know they need us. They need us here. They need us to shut down these factories, these armed factories. They need to shut down. And really, the whole American system is just upside down and backwards, just like Israelis. You know, it has to come down, not only to liberate Palestinians, but to liberate us, because we're also not free. And that was something that I didn't experience this the first time I was there, but people would yell out their windows at us when they'd see us. And instead of saying free Palestine, they're like, free Washington. It was really amazing seeing how many people there also realize that, like, we're not free. You know, sure, I'm free to, like, consume whatever I want and, like, step on whoever I want. But when it really comes down to it, we're not free.
And before we end, do you have any final thoughts?
Yeah, I just want to encourage people to find their warrior spirit. And if you feel like you have any calling to go to Palestine, please reach out to ISM, or could reach out to me. It's a life-changing thing. It's priceless for them. It's priceless for us. It's not as hard as you would think. You're not going to be forced to do anything you don't want to do. You can step back whenever you want, step forward whenever you want. There's people fundraising to help other people go. I feel like most people don't go because the hardest part is stepping away from life here, because it's so expensive to, you know, leave your apartment or leave your job. So I think financially, I think that's the hardest part. And so people need to find community to help them in that.
That was Alex on their experience in the West Bank with the International Solidarity Movement. They were thrown out of Israel and banned for 99 years for their efforts. That is it for the People's Program today. I'm your host, Rosie Boltman.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eister composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Meher Ali. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today, or to listen to past segments at kcbx.org.